Hey there, welcome to Night School. We got a double feature tonight. Second episode tonight, the day before my birthday double feature. Got a lot on my mind, and I don't really want to do one of these on my birthday. I don't know why either. It seems like a good thing to do on my birthday, like I'd have some extra birthday energy to offer. But just something doesn't sit right with me about doing one on my birthday. And the topic here I'm going to explore today starts out with identity. And when you hear identity, you tend to think of something that makes a person unique, someone's identity. He had his identity stolen. He had his identity stolen. You tend to think of, their most unique characteristics, what defines that person as an individual in contrast with everybody else. That person's lone individual identity. Somebody stole his identity. They are pretending to be him. And I think about identity a lot in our various identities that we as individuals have, despite supposedly having this one core identity. But I started thinking about it again because I was thinking about the word identical. And even though the word identity tends to mean, who you are as an individual, that's often how it's used, the word identical means quite the opposite, which is, two things that are exactly the same, or more than two things, identical twins. You could have hundreds of people who are identical, who have some shared identity, because an identity doesn't have to be your lone characteristics. It's also, when you hear people talk about identity politics or, just the different groups that we are assigned to and that we assign ourselves to, that is also your identity. And when you have a shared identity with someone, it makes you, in theory, identical. It's not simply being exactly alike, but it's having some sort of shared characteristic. So it's weird that we use that phrase both to refer to what makes us supposedly, allegedly, a lone individual, and we also use it in a way that associates us with a group, or more likely, many groups. A white male. Well, white, that's one part of the identity. Male is another part of the identity. And they're separate identities that crosshatch. People kind of get preoccupied with the power of identity. And we often feel limited by the identities that are assigned to us in different ways. Some people feel that they were assigned the wrong gender, and they feel that being called, say, a woman is limiting them. Even if they're not transgender, even if they're something else, there are women who feel that they are women, and they identify with the term woman, but they still feel like being referred to as a woman is limiting. And the same goes for men. The same goes for virtually anything that you call someone. And there are those identities that you are born into. Whether you like it or not, there are some that people will call you. They will refer to you using that identity. And as I was saying, people feel limited by those. And sometimes we reject that outright, and sometimes we don't, but we still will find other ways to define ourselves. We will find other identities to either take the place of that one or to add on to it. And in that way, we will find other identities so that we can kind of expand ourselves. In the same way that certain identities might limit us, even if you are completely fine just being a white man, you might feel that you don't want to just be a white man. You might also want to be a communist. You also might want to be a Republican. You might also want to be a sports fan. And some of these things people don't really grasp onto fully. Like some people just casually into something. A lot of people watch football, but they might not just offer up to the world that they are a football fan. They might not own a jersey. They might not, dress up for Blue Friday. That's something we do as Seahawks fans. We wear Seahawks clothes or blue clothes on Fridays before the Sunday football game to show that we support our team. And that's a great example of, letting your fandom become an identity. And I do it. I dress up for Blue Friday. I wouldn't say I dress up. I wear a Seahawks shirt, maybe a Seahawks hat. But I still do it. And in doing that, I show that I'm not just a casual fan, maybe not the most hardcore fan. I might not wear the full getup. Like, there's a guy who goes to all the games who dresses up like this Hulk. He dresses up like the Incredible Hulk, but like a Seahawks version in a Seahawks hard hat. You know, and that guy, that is, he has an identity. I mean, he's kind of gone full circle to back what I was talking about at the beginning, where he's part of this Seahawks fan identity, the 12th man, as we are referred to, but he's gone full circle and he's found this individual identity within that. He's the guy who dresses up as the Incredible Hulk and sits in the front row and goes shirtless, you know, in the middle of winter, wearing a hard hat and makeup and, you know, his body's green. You know, that guy has his own identity. But then he's also he's an Incredible Hulk cosplayer. So there's other Incredible Hulk cosplayers out there. So while he may be the only Seahawks fan who dresses up as the Incredible Hulk, there are 100 people at every, you know, all across the country going to comic book comic cons. Never thought about how much that sounds like kamikaze when you're just saying it out loud. He goes to kamikaze comic cons. You know, there's a bunch of guys who dress up like the Incredible Hulk there. So that guy has an identity that then intersects with other Incredible Hulk cosplayers. So it's really this kind of endless game where, you know, if you do something that makes you stand out as an individual, there's a good chance that thing that makes you an individual also puts you in yet another group of people who do that same thing. And I mean, I think you can see it in subcultures where if you're walking down a suburban street and you see someone who's just a balls out heavy metal fan, a death metal, black metal fan, and they have a leather jacket that has the patches, they're in a band shirt, they might even have, you know, they have studs, spikes, whatever, long hair, a bullet belt. That person's going to stand out. That person is an individual with a very unique identity going into Starbucks, you know. And then you go to a show, though. You go to the show that person is going to that Friday night, the death metal show, and you look around, and it's a sea of people who look exactly like that person. So once again, like the Incredible Hulk Seahawk fan, you have this person who has this very unique identity that makes him stand out in Starbucks. But then when he's at the show, he's one of many. You know, some people want that. Some people want to have a place they can go where they blend in. As much as they like to stand out, they also like knowing that they can join their people. I don't know how the Incredible Hulk guy feels. I don't know that he meets up with other Incredible Hulk fans, other Incredible Hulk enthusiasts, cosplayers. I don't know that he does that. But many people do enjoy standing out in one context and then kind of fitting in another. I do. I feel the same way, too, in certain ways. Not necessarily in that overt of a way where I like to dress up as something, but I think there is a comfort to being among your own. But it stands out to me that we have these this need to expand ourselves. And as I was saying earlier, before I started talking about Hulks, there's this need to expand beyond the identities that are given to us, whether we accept those original identities or not. Whether, you know, you might be born a man and you feel like you're a woman, and so you reject that initial identity and you want a new one. You want to be called a woman from then on. But as I was saying, you might not do that. You might feel totally comfortable being a man. You feel like a man. You are a man. But that's not really enough. That doesn't make you stand out enough. It doesn't make you feel like you're doing something of your own. So what you might do is you might, you know, adopt a certain ideology, and that ideology comes with an ist to go with the ism. You know, fascism, you got into fascism, so now you're a fascist, and you tell everybody you're a fascist. You got into communism, so you tell everybody you're a communist. And not everybody who likes those ideas necessarily adopts the identity, but a lot of people do. It's something that kind of expands who they are. But in expanding who they are, they also limit themselves in another way, because once you expand into this other identity, you suddenly are limited by the boundaries that surround that. And we are constantly setting up boundaries and rules. And when you have a group, someone's going to enforce some set of rules. It's what we do. Someone's going to have a checklist of things that you're supposed to believe. And oftentimes you're supposed to believe most, if not all, of those things, or at least be agreeable to them. And then from there, you know, you're expected to follow a certain set of rules, you know, and it kind of develops naturally. You see it even in artistic and musical subcultures. You see it a lot in those, where these are things that spun out of the void. You think about how far music has traveled over the last 60 years, let's say. You know, you think about rock and roll in the 1950s, rockabilly, and just what that was. You still had men wearing suits, but they started playing distorted guitar, and they started playing something called rock and roll, and how that was groundbreaking, and it was a way to escape the existing boundaries of earlier musical identities. And so rock and roll was this new thing that didn't have boundaries, and then that very quickly, as that developed into a true genre, that genre had rules and boundaries, and if you did something outside of that, it either became something else or it became something that wasn't okay, and you end up with purists, you know, and I think some identities are more prone to that sort of, I was going to say purism, but I think it's just a puritanical, you know, puritanism. I think that's a good way to put it. There, things are more prone to puritanism, and sometimes they are the most unlikely things. Sometimes the most unlikely things are the most prone to puritanism. I think you can look at punk rock, heavy metal, you know, these leather and spikes subcultures that are all about defying norms develop their own norms and their own rules. And I know this is all obvious. I know people have seen this play out, and people were commenting on it when those ideas were new, when those were new things, when heavy metal, punk rock were new things. People were aware of it even then, you know, because it happens that quickly. Things form boundaries and rules that quickly. And when those boundaries and rules are set, they create this new spirit of competition within the group where people are competing to uphold the rules or to have a superior definition of the rules. And you see that a lot with religious sects. You think about the wars that are going on in the Middle East, in places like Iraq, where you have different Islamic groups that all, you know, originally took their word from the Prophet Muhammad, but people then followed the different followers of Muhammad. Someone's following this interpretation, someone's following that interpretation, and you see that sort of factionalism that leads to this insane competition between people that ultimately are under the same umbrella. And you see it in something as, you know, simple and petty as a musical subgenre. Who's more true to the original art form, or who has a better who's able to evolve the art form better while still staying true to the initial vision or rules? But you also see it in people killing each other over religion, over this and that. We really do it in every way that we can possibly do it as a species. And how's that for a shared identity? Our species, human. But there, I think there's a healthy element of competition, too. Even though there is that sort of, I uphold the rules better, or I interpret the rules better, I've pushed the rules in a better direction by thinking of it this way, by rephrasing it this way, by reinterpreting it that way. Even though, you know, there's a certain form, and good can come of that too. I'm not saying that that's inherently bad, but it does often end up being pretty toxic and even dangerous depending on what that group is and what their purpose is. But I think there's a good spirit of competition too, and it's what I would call cooperative competition. And to go back to football, I think you can see it in sports. I think it's very evident in sports because we look at sports and we think like, competition, people who dislike each other, who hate each other, who are fighting, who are, you know, up against, you know, each other. And we tend to see that as a bad thing. Not everybody. I mean, there are millions of sports fans, but there's a certain type of person who sees that, who grew up in school and they didn't like the idea of playing sports because the competition just seemed too aggressive and too toxic. And butting heads with another human being that way was just not something they could handle. They got a bad taste in their mouth from it that they just couldn't shake. But I think if you take one step outside of that perspective, you take a few steps back, you will see that while you might have two teams who are competing and they might be violently hitting each other, let's use football as an example, the only sport I care about. You have two teams who are violently hitting each other. They are mad. They are operating at their full animal capacity to go up against and struggle with another human being. I feel like that could mean a lot of different things. But in this case, it's just football. And, you know, that seems really bad. It seems like, you know, almost like war. It seems like people struggling in war. But then you say, look at the amount of cooperation that is going on, not just within the individual teams on each side, not just within the team that has a quarterback who's cooperating with his running back and his linemen and all that, but between the two opposing teams, there is a higher level of cooperation. There is an organism. There is the individual organisms, you know, in your mind are like, oh, it's the Seahawks against the Packers, and each one of those represents an organism. But when they play each other, there is a larger organism that gets created, which is the game, and they are all playing by the same rules. And even if some guys break the rules, hopefully the refs will catch it. Most guys don't want to hurt each other. Everyone, you know, there's guys like Ndamukong Suh. There's different guys who are known, they're bad seeds. They are known for playing dirty and actually trying to hurt other players on opposing teams. But they are really the exception, and that's why we know their names. That's why we know who Bill Romanowski is, retired Bill Romanowski. I think I actually played a Bill Romanowski sample on here of him in an interview because he has the goofiest voice. Almost sounds like a gay man, but maybe he is, but just known for brutalizing even his own teammates, just a vicious, nasty player. But there's a reason why those guys are so memorable as dirty players. It's because most people, even if they hit each other hard, even if they're playing, you know, to their full beast ability, they are ultimately cooperating in this game where they are both trying to do the same things. Both teams are literally trying to do the exact same thing. If you can play, you know, people call it a copycat league where you have a team who does something. Say they blitz on first down. Every drive, they blitz on first down. It's not normal. Most teams don't blitz on first down, but this team has decided to blitz on first down. They send all their linebackers, even a defensive back. And they've had great success at it. They have the best defense in the league. Well, what's going to happen is the other team is going to end up doing that too. Teams are going to learn from that. If this offense, you know, runs this, they run the play action this way. Other teams are going to adopt that. And so in that way, there's this greater collaboration that goes on even outside of the individual game in the organism that is the NFL, that is the league, because the league is a whole other organism. The league is made up of these games that are going on between these other smaller organisms, and they ultimately mimic each other because they want to succeed, and they all want to succeed in the same way. They all want the ball, and they all want to score, and they all want to stop the other team from scoring. And, you know, yeah, certain teams might run four wide receivers. They might be more likely to run three wide receivers, two tight ends. They might have different arrangements, but for the most part, teams are a mirror image of each other. You have this many linemen, this many receivers, they have this body type. You know, the quarterback, he sits in shotgun or he goes, you know, behind center. Ultimately, they do the same things more often than they do not. When they do something incredibly strange, like have two quarterbacks in the backfield, like a wildcat, it's almost unheard of in the pros. So people point it out. They're like, whoa, what the hell is going on? What are these guys doing? It's like the Saints this year with that Taysom Hill guy. It's like, you know, oh, this guy's playing quarterback this round. Drew Brees is playing wideout. What the hell's going on? When they do things that completely break the mold, it is huge news because ultimately things are more similar than they are not. But because these teams wear different colors and they're fighting against each other, there's a tendency to think like, oh, this is just like primitive, bare bones, male aggression. It's hostile. It's basically simulated warfare. But no, everybody agrees to do this. They all get bussed in or flown into the game. Fans come in and they, you know, despite fans, you know, wearing different colors and rooting for different teams, they all sit in the same stadium. They sit in the same seats. They're mixed in with each other. And that even is a form of cooperation, because fights in the crowd are pretty rare. I grew up going to Seahawk games. That was back when the Seahawks were in the AFC, and one of their rivals was the Raiders. When the Raiders came to town, there tended to be more fights. That sub-organism is a little rougher than other fan bases, you know, so there tended to be more fights. But security clamped down, you know, if the players broke the rules, the refs throw their flags. You know, there's regulation going on. And so, you know, and so many things do show that same form of cooperation. So many things that seem otherwise at odds show a similar sort of cooperation. And cooperation is more the norm than it isn't. You know, you think about a body, and there are things inside of your body that seem to be working against each other. But ultimately, your body as a whole is more a product of cooperation than it is competition. And I'm not a scientist. I don't know much about human anatomy, so I can't break down all the different things that are going on in that. I only know football, guys. I only know football. But still, I think you do have to take that bigger picture look when possible. And when you think something is a certain way, just take a step back and be like, you know, there's a greater harmony going on here than I previously realized. But I think too often when we grab hold of an identity and then join up with others who are identical to us in that way, we forget about the greater harmony. I think we forget that we are playing a game. And I think in some ways we leave the game. And in the same way that certain players are dirty players because they are an exception to the rule, they are the exceptions in, say, the game of football, I think that we do enter into these other kind of non-games where the exception is the rule-abiding player and the norm is the dirty player. And I think you can see that in politics. Although I do have to say, you know, for being as hostile as it is, the American political climate is surprisingly nonviolent. Sure, there's political violence. Absolutely, it happens. People do get violent with each other in this country to different extremes. But considering how hostile it is and how angry people are, especially right now in this current time period, it's actually amazing there isn't more violence. And yeah, we do have to constantly worry that it's just bubbling under the surface and it's just going to boil over at any given time. But there is a spirit of cooperation that is winning out even if you don't really see it right now. Just a participation in a certain process. And just because things have swung one way or another way at any given time period doesn't mean that in the bigger picture there is more cooperation than competition. But that remains to be seen, because I don't see war as anything like football. In the same way I just mentioned how, you know, the dirty players are the norm in something like politics, well, they are absolutely the norm in something like war. I think war makes a mockery of rules. I think war makes a mockery of cooperation. That same sort of cooperation I was talking about when I was discussing the game of football, I think war makes a mockery of that. It's almost a cruel imitation of it. And it, unfortunately, is probably the original form of that. It probably came before anything. So in that way, maybe it's not an imitation. It was probably the earliest incarnation. And maybe football is a less cruel imitation, would actually be a better way to kind of put that in order. But war is truly not a game in which everybody is following the rules. We have these phony rules where we say, you can't use chemical weapons. You can't do this. You can't use mustard gas. You can't commit war crimes, but yet we're going to kill you with drones. We're going to bayonet you. I'm going to shoot you, and if you're still breathing, I'm going to bayonet you. You know, we act as if that is okay. But really, the whole thing is a corruption of rules. It's a corruption of competition. It comes from a much deeper and darker place. And maybe in the grand scheme of things, there's some necessity to it. Maybe to beings that are much larger than us, that can't see through our eyes, that don't live on this world, human warfare is just different organisms participating in a larger organism that is war, which itself has some greater purpose. But it's very difficult for us to see that because of the horror of it all. a horror that goes beyond the broken bones of sports, that goes beyond the black eyes of even something like, fighting, competitive fighting. It's something that goes much deeper and it's much sicker. But I think we can find ways to harmonize with each other even more than we do, and I don't think we do it enough. I think we split off into these identities and we use that as an excuse to go head-to-head with each other, and not in an organized way. We do it in a very disorganized way. And I think that's ultimately what war comes from. I think war comes from the disorganization of man. I think sport, the joy of sport, comes from organization, from putting things together and giving it some nice boundaries. And maybe, rocking those boundaries just enough to make it exciting, but not breaking them down. You think about these soccer riots, the other football riots. Soccer, the other football. But you think about those riots, and that's when the boundaries break down and things get closer to war, but they are extremely disorganized. And if you've seen actual depictions of war, no matter how organized the armies are and their strategy, it's ultimately mass disorganization. But sports do have boundaries. And even though things do devolve into riots, even here in America, sometimes there are sports riots. And even though that does happen, and fans might scream obscenities, and players might shove each other, they might get a little bit chippy, as announcers have started saying in recent years. Oh, there's lots of shoving going on after the play. There's lots of shoving going on here between these division rivals. Things are getting a little bit chippy. Which is also a term that's used for fish and chip stands in the UK, going down to the chippy. Things are getting a little bit chippy during the game, so I think I'm going to go down to the chippy and get something to eat. Just use chippy in any way you want it. It's a universal word for fighting and for eating. Getting chippy at the chippy. So even though, sports do rock the boundaries and sometimes the boundaries do break down a little bit, ultimately things are more organized than they are not. But still, I think that we have to be aware of opportunities to harmonize. And, while we might initially choose some new identity for ourselves and then we kind of harmonize with the group identity associated with that, I'm a somethingist. And then, I think like a somethingist. But we don't like the otherists over there. We don't like them, and you go into conflict with them. And so we often look for opportunities to butt heads. It's like we form an individual identity for ourselves, and then we find ways to harmonize with other people who have that identity. But then once we join up with other people who have that identity, we find this greater disharmony with people that we supposedly disagree with, people who don't follow our rules, people who don't have the same view of things. And, I think we need to find smaller opportunities to harmonize, smaller opportunities with fewer rules. Because I think, it's hard to create something like football. It's hard to create something that has that greater harmony at play. You can't just build that out of nowhere. It's really a phenomena that you can't just create. It has to be a really good game. it has to be, even if it's not a sports game, it has to be a really good game, I think, in order to become a truly, you gotta knock your mic off the stand. But you have to do a lot of work to create something that is a multifaceted organism like that, that has cooperative competition that doesn't boil over. So I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to create another football. I don't know how to create something like that. But what I do know is that certain people have shared experiences that they don't really talk about often enough. And I think that even just your name can be that. You think about if your name is Eric, for example. My name is Eric. And there's a whole group of people out there who their entire lives have responded, who turn their head every time someone makes that sound, Eric. Or maybe let's go with Mike. It's not all about me. This isn't all about me. So let's go with Mike. Every time someone says the name Mike, you turn your head because that's your name and it's always been your name. And everybody who's ever been named Mike has done the same thing. It's something you all have in common. And, you know, don't you have some kind of kinship? Don't you have something that other people don't have that should bring you together? Doesn't hearing that word your entire life shape you in some way and make you similar to other people who respond to that word in that same way? You see it in families, you know. If someone's name is John Smith the Fourth, you know, that's four generations of men who have literally turned their head to the same exact sound. How many people can say that? How many people can say that I turn my head at the same exact sound that other people do? You know, yeah, if someone says, hey, there are some general words we throw out there that make anybody look up. Watch out, you know, everyone's gonna, you know, suddenly be attentive. But a name, that has some power. So I think we need to, you know, find shared identities in things like names, silly things. Does that mean going to meetings where everybody has the same name? I've heard about jokes like that, conventions, name conventions. Maybe we do need that. You know, maybe we do need to all get together with people who have the same name we do. And then form games of cooperative competition with people who share our names. Maybe that's the next step. Maybe that's the way that we are going to create another game like football or something that's equally complicated, equally competitive, but has this greater harmony and cooperation. It's going to come from meeting up with people who have our name and forming a game out of that. What that game looks like, I have no idea. But then again, I haven't met with the other Erics yet, and I'll let you know when I do.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave, this golden land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, I see a land where children can.